Mainstream science is trying hard to keep you from understanding the truth about what reality is, what you are, what God is, what's really going on. This is an amazing thing. It's been going on for actually a couple of thousand years, but most recently and most intensely for the past century. As a result, mainstream science is off the rails, but what's more important is that you're kind of off the rails. You're not sure what to believe. Do you turn to religion? Do you turn to science? Where's the truth? Well, the reason that I call these podcasts Seek Reality is that that's what all of us are doing now. And when you do actually look at reality open-mindedly, trying to understand what the truth really is, you find an extraordinary reality, which is far more wonderful than anything any of us have ever been told about. This is Seek Reality, and I'm Roberta Grimes, and I'm going to be my own guest today because right at the start of this series of podcasts, I'd like to begin to help you know what's really going on. The big question that started me on this journey is, what happens when we die? Where are our loved ones now? I mean, where's the cloud they're sitting on? All of the things that I had been raised to believe didn't make any sense ultimately, and a lot of them were mutually inconsistent. How did we figure this out? Well, that started me on my journey, and I recount what I learned in my book, The Fun of Dying, Find Out What Really Happens Next. What I came to understand, though, as I continued my research, was that we were finding out not just what happens to the dead, not just where they are now or whether our minds will survive or any of that, but we were discovering, the other people doing this work and there are a lot of people who have done afterlife-related research beginning probably 100 years ago very intensively, what we were learning was nothing less than a whole new physics. Now, I never even took physics in high school. I couldn't care less about physics. Hate math. But if physics is a study of what reality actually is and how it works, then what we've discovered is a whole new physics. What I'm going to do today is tell you what I've learned about where the dead are, what it's like there, what it feels like to die, what's going on. And I'm going to try to do it, you know, in 40 minutes in fairly simple terms, because a lot of what we'll be talking about going forward is going to be based on your having a sense or an understanding of all of this. To understand how reality is constructed, the first thing you've got to know is that nothing is solid. Your body feels as if it's solid and your hand can't go through your desk only because they're both made out of the same matter. And the matter they're made out of is virtually all space, empty space. If the White House were a neutron, whatever they put in the middle of the nucleus of the atom, if the White House were the nucleus of the atom, the closest orbiting electron would be in Denver somewhere, and there'd be nothing between them. That's a lot of empty space. And now they've discovered, as they drilled down into these atoms, that all of what they used to think were particles are actually vortices of energy, all empty space. The great Bruce Lipton, who is a wonderful quantum biologist, so to speak. He uses quantum mechanics to study biology with wonderful results. Bruce Lipton says if you could put a camera inside an atom, there'd be nothing for it to photograph because it's all energy. Wow, what an insight. That's the same kind of thing the dead tell us. We know a lot about what it's like to be dead because there have been a lot of dead people who have communicated with us directly. The most, I think, important communications were received in the first half of the 20th century, and that's where I concentrated my research for really decades. Deep trance mediums were active then. There really are none now, and the people who would come to them to talk to grieving relatives would ask the relatives questions about where they were, what it was like there, and so on, and the answers they got were enormously detailed. If you read enough of these communications, you come to understand that it has to all be real because they're all consistent with one another. They all had different experiences, but they all were going to the same place. And how exciting it is to discover that. Wow, it's like a whole new continent, a whole new planet, a whole new world that we've discovered in realizing that you really can know what it's like for the dead and what it's going to be like for us when we get to where they are, which will be all for all of us very soon. Time is so fleeting. You only realize that when you reach your 60s, where I am now, and you say, wow, where did all that time go? Well, time isn't, as you'll learn in a minute, time is active only on this level of reality, and this level of reality is a tiny part of what we know exists, and there may be more that we don't know about. So time is kind of subjective anyway. Let's look at where the dead are. Well, the easiest way to understand this is if you think of your mind as a television set. You know, if you had a TV in the room where you are now, you could turn it on and you could pick up a whole lot of different channels just in that same spot. Tune it to channel 2, tune it to channel 10. There are different realities basically inside your TV set, which really were picked up as signals in the room. That is very much like what your mind experiences as reality. Right now, your mind is tuned to this level of reality and to that body on this level of reality, and your mind is quite immersed in the thought that it is inside that body, but it's not. It's connected to what amounts to a two-way radio in the head of a meat robot. That's really what your brain is. It's nothing fancy. And there's a lot of ways we can know that your mind is not generated by your brain, and we can talk about some of those, but in fact, it's not. Your brain is a receiver and transmitter, and your mind is very much like, remember the movie Avatar? Everyone has seen Avatar. Right now, the body you think you're in is just that blue body that Jake used to explore an alien planet, and right now you're using it to explore an alien planet. Very simple. That's how it works. And there, all those levels of reality are in exactly the same place, much as all those TV signals are in the same place, just one gets picked up by the TV or by the mind. When it's time to die, all that happens is that your mind tunes to a higher vibratory rate, and there it picks up a whole new solid reality, just as solid as the reality you think you see around you now. They're both made of energy. That one is made of a different kind of energy, and here it would be good to have scientists actually paying attention. Once they discover that they have to study all of this, they'll be able to tell us a lot more about the kind of energy that exists in most of reality. We researchers call it spiritual energy because that's what we think of it as, but it doesn't. I'm not sure what it is. One of the things we learn as we study this information is essentially what God is. God is nothing like what the Christians or any other religion I've ever seen tells us God is. God is instead, and this is the best definition I've seen, it's not my definition, but it resonates with what I've learned about the eternal energy that is all that exists. An energy-like potentiality without size or form, infinitely powerful, alive in the same way that your mind is alive, highly emotional, and therefore probably self-aware. That's the best definition of God I've ever come across. It's what we learn from the dead is true. They call this energy-like potentiality God. The dead, even if they were atheists here, they all know God exists and God is real and God is right there. But they don't. They also understand God doesn't have a beard. God never has judged anyone. We found no evidence, and we've looked hard for it, that God ever has judged a single human being or any religious figure ever has. Instead, as I'll tell you in a moment, we're our own judge. And actually, Jesus tells us all of this in the Gospels. It's just that Christianity ignores the Gospels by and large, except if it suits the dogmas that the religion is built upon. But Jesus says it. He first says God doesn't judge you. He's entrusted all judgment to the Son. And then when you kind of get that, he says, as for me, I don't judge you. I didn't come to judge the world. I came to save it. And then finally, he says, in the manner that you judge, you will be judged. With the measure you use, it will be measured out to you. And that's exactly what happens. If we learn to be forgiving here, it's easier for us to forgive ourselves there when we basically are asked to review our lives, understand how we affected others, and forgive ourselves. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So there are what we think of as six about layers of afterlife reality. They're just at higher vibratory rates and in the same place as the spiritual, rather material universe, or so-called material universe, which really also is spiritual. They're all in the same place. It's not an onion with layers above. It's just as with your TV set, there are some channels that are much higher than others. And what allows you to go to a higher vibratory rate, and the levels get more beautiful the higher you can go, is your level of spiritual development. The better you have learned the things that, actually most of the great religious teachers, but I use Jesus. Jesus says, learn to love perfectly and learn to forgive completely. The better you've learned that, the easier it is to go to higher vibratory levels. Let's talk briefly about what those levels are, and then we're going to talk about how we get there. The lowest vibratory rate of or level of which we are aware is what Jesus called the outer darkness, where there's wailing and gnashing of teeth. That's a very good description. It's the punishment level, and it's horrendous. It's like midnight on a garbage dump with rabbiting dogs around you that are actually people. It's a horrible, horrible place, smelly, dark, and disgusting. And it's where people are put by themselves when they can't forgive themselves. I've never seen any evidence that anyone was put there by anybody else. It seems to be a problem. If you are not able to forgive yourself, your vibratory rate lowers to the point where you can't sustain even level two, and you end up in level one, and you can't get out on your own. So that's a good reason to learn to forgive and love right now so you don't end up there. The level above that, level two, is sort of a recovery level, or seems to be. It's darkish there, but it's not actively punitive. And people, again, condemn themselves there if you have trouble forgiving themselves. It's a longer story, I think, that I'll have to tell today, but But my father was there for quite a long time. I hope he's out of it now, because he was an alcoholic in life, and he had trouble forgiving himself. I didn't even realize he was there for 20 years after his death. Levels 3 through 5 are what the dead call, and we call, most people at this point call, the Summerland. Some people call it heaven, levels 3 through 5. I don't use heaven because I see it as a religious term. And at this point, we're trying to get beyond religious dogmas because, remember, we're trying to seek reality. We want to know what's actually true. We don't care what other people have believed. We know we can get to the truth and understand it and study it and accept it on our own. So we're working on doing that. And we're not alone. There are a lot of people now worldwide who are undertaking this study. And the fun thing is, whenever I meet someone new who's spent a lot of effort in studying all of this, we complete each other's sentences. Everybody has reached the same conclusions about reality, and that is thrilling. So, okay, we have the levels through 3 through 5, the beautiful Summerland. That's a Viking term, by the way, that you can imagine if you lived in the cold and snowy north, you'd like the notion of going to a Summerland at death. Level 6, which is the level right below the source level, or what they tell us is the source level, level 6 is mostly non-material, apparently. It's highly, highly love, charged with love, beautiful. The people who have made it to that level are very advanced beings, and they tend to be of service in the lower levels and on the earth, teaching spiritually. And there are wonderful stories I could tell about level 6 beings and what they're doing now, which if we have time today, I'll try to get to. But so that's what's going on. All of those levels, each of them seems to be about the size of the universe. They're very big, so it's much less crowded there than here. They feel as solid as here, but they're perfect in that nothing decays, nothing dies, just beautiful details they give us at all. First we're going to go back into a body, and then I'll tell you when we get there a lot more about what it's like. This is Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes, and I should just say quickly, my website is robertagrimes.com. I answer emails, and my books, my nonfiction books, are The Fun of Dying and The Fun of Staying in Touch, which is about how people communicate with us after death. Most people are not aware of just the intensity with which the dead are trying to get word to us of their survival and are trying to keep our relationships going. So I'm hearing from people that The Fun of Staying in Touch just came out this fall, and I'm hearing, or last fall, in 2014, and I'm hearing from people who have read it and have had wonderful experiences with their dead loved ones who were so anxious for the people still here to know that they were okay and to be alert for the signs. So that's very satisfying. So, all right, here we are. We are in a dying body. Now, How you got there matters, of course, from the perspective of the earth. You don't want a lingering death, but it doesn't matter from the perspective of the actual death event. We plan our lives. All the bad things that happen in your life, the evidence is overwhelming that you plan those things. As this is like a day in the gym, and you plan to go to the gym and really strengthen those spiritual muscles, and that's why you planned in that awful first husband or that, you know, terrible girlfriend who broke your heart or a bad job, all the horrible things that you plan in and you go, darn it, and even the really terrible things like a child dying, that we plan those events as spiritual lessons. I don't believe very much happens that's major, that's accidental. But again, that's one of the things we're not sure about, but we're pretty sure based on what the dead tell us. We plan all that. And one of the things we plan, of course, is the opportunity to leave, because this is like a very bad day in the gym or a very bad day in school. We don't want to stay longer than we have to, and then it's productive for our learning. So we plan two or three exit points into our lives. Usually one is youngish, maybe one is middle-aged, and one is in old age. And our higher consciousness makes the decision that it's ready to go, because there's nothing we can learn now, and we're pretty set. So we plan our deaths. There's a lot of evidence that many people are aware on some subconscious level, even if it's not a time when you would think they would be dying. They're aware that they're about to leave. A few years back, a friend of mine died in his sleep. No one really knows why. They think it was heart-related, but they don't know. He was only, I think he was 51 or something, some young age like that. And when I went to the celebration of his life and talked to people who had known him, I knew him in a work way, so there was a whole bunch of people there I didn't know, but we talked about his life, and over and over and over again, people were saying, you know, I hadn't heard from him in years, I just heard from him, or he planned this or that trip. Well, they finally took it last summer. He had been wrapping his life up for that year. And I hear from widows sometimes who say, it's amazing, he didn't know he was dying, but 2 weeks or 2 months or something before he died, he told me where all the money was or what the passwords were or whatever detail that his higher consciousness knew she was going to need, he gave her without any conscious awareness he was going to die. As we get close, whatever the means of our dying might be, certain things happen, and that these are repeatedly reported. One thing that happens is we usually have a surge of health within 24 hours to 36 before the death happens. We are often conscious again, we're sitting up, we're doing things. If someone is dying of a brain problem, Alzheimer's or just senile dementia, very often it's reported that that person is temporarily lucid sometime within the last 12 hours. They'll come back to who they were. I heard yesterday someone talking about how his grandmother had sat up in bed and started talking to people that no one else could see, and she had been utterly comatose. Her brain had been totally fried. That seems to be what happens, because, of course, your brain is not where your consciousness comes from, and as your consciousness begins to raise its vibratory rate in preparation for leaving, it seems to be able to escape the prison of the brain. So that's a common thing. If you talk to people who work in hospices, you'll hear those stories. As we get closer to dying, we begin to see people we used to know in life who have died. Mom, our cat from when we were a baby, anybody we most will love and trust seems to be who comes. And it could be one person, it could be one animal, or it could be a whole crowd. There are reports of parties that go on among the dead in the room where someone is dying. Whatever. This is a very personal time to you if you're the person who's leaving, and it's important, I think, for the living to respect that. And whatever is going to make you happiest seems to be what they're game to do for you. People who are coming to see you typically, where it's reported, will appear in the upper corners of the room. So if you're at a deathbed and you see someone lying there, you know, sort of looking at a corner of the room and not saying anything, that person is almost certainly talking with deathbed visitors in his or her mind. These are not hallucinations. These are real visitations. People who don't get them typically are only people who are so sedated or so drugged that interferes with what is a natural process, which is one reason I think it's important we all insist upon having drugs withdrawn if we possibly can. The pain of dying seems to lessen anyway as we get close to death. And you really don't want to miss this. This is the best time for most of us, the best time of our lives. The minute you see the first deathbed visitor, you will know your life is eternal. There's Mom. I know I'm going where she is. And she's talking to me in my mind. I can hear her voice. And she's telling me it's going to be fine. I'm going to be here in a few more hours. I'm going to be leaving with her. And everybody's waiting. And they're going to have a party. It's just the best experience. To have that certainty suddenly dawn on you because there are your loved ones, that your life is eternal. You're going someplace good. So then what happens, of course, is that your body weakens further. If you want to think about what your body really is and how that works, the easiest way to think of yourself is as an energy-based Matryoshka doll, a Russian doll, nested dolls. The outer couple of layers of that nested doll are going to stay. Of course, your material body, which is one of those energy layers, is going to stay. And it appears what we think of as the aura, which is the outermost energy body that's been protecting you in life from negative spiritual influences. It appears that stays too, although I'm not sure about that. Some of the interior dolls, though, body-shaped energy, which really are you, are who you are, those are leaving, and they begin to roll up from your extremities, from your feet, from your hands, and into your torso. People who have died and described this experience, if you're awake during your death, you'll feel it too. They say it doesn't hurt. It's just interesting. You can actually feel your energy gathering in your torso, and that's what happens. Then either through the top of your head, where with the fontanelle, where you're not supposed to touch a baby, or through your chest. I think it's usually through the fontanelle, but we're not. That's again, sort of typically not consistent. Somehow that energy that's gathered in your torso leaves your body. It's still attached by what the Bible calls a silver cord, which is basically a cord you can see when you're out of body. It's a glowing cord. Been very strong during your life. You frequently left your body during your life, although you're not aware of it probably. And that cord was tough. You could go to the end of the universe and that cord wouldn't break. But now you're about to die and it's a natural death and the cord is fraying. You're still attached for a bit. And I should just say that energy, people who see the energy leaving a body of a person who's dying, say it looks like a mist, a grayish glowing mist. But it reforms into a body, and it doesn't have any clothes on, so immediately your mind makes clothes for it. And so there you are. You're an energy body beside what amounts to a boat anchor, this dying, awful old body, and you have no attachment to it. You couldn't care less about it. That's what they tell us. They know that's not who they were. It was just a vehicle to get around. It's like an old Toyota. They just push it aside. At that point, it's good to, as soon as possible, as soon as that cord frays and then seems to disintegrate, they tell us, that's when you leave. People around the bed may be upset. Maybe it's been a gathering for days. They've been hoping you'd survive. Maybe it was an accident or something, and nobody thought you would die, and there you are. Suddenly, they realize there's no pulse. People will be upset around your bed unless this is a natural death that everyone anticipated. That being the case, you can't try to help them. Your instinct is to say, wow, I feel terrific. I feel terrific. And the problem is you really aren't terrific yet. You don't know anything. You're as clueless as a baby. And because you don't know what's going on, and the temptation is to try to comfort the people around your bed. The people who've come to get you are going to try to lure you away. It seems to be the case that if you try to comfort those around your bed before you yourself have transitioned, you will lower your spiritual vibratory rate and you may not be able to see your deathbed visitors anymore. If that happens, you're stuck outside of time in a place, in a physical place, and that's how I think, that's how we make ghosts. The evidence is still inconclusive. I don't know of anyone who's studying this as a specialty. It's because it's kind of a depressing one. But the evidence is pretty strong that some people do get left behind, and this seems to be a reason why, because we do have evidence that you lower your vibratory rate if you try to communicate with the living before you've transitioned. So whatever you do, you've heard it from me. Do not try to talk to anybody who's living once you are out of your body. Go with the people who've come for you, because those people are going to take you where you're going. They're going to take you very easily through what people say. People who've been through this don't usually describe a tunnel and a light. In fact, I don't remember seeing any reference to a tunnel and a light in all of the early 20th century communications that I read. That seems to be a later device, and I think it's a rescue device, really. People are being saved in hospitals from death much more often now than they were, you know, say pre-1950 or even pre-1970 or earlier than that. Now it's not uncommon for someone to have to be so close to death that effectively they leave their bodies, but they get called back in. That seems to be the reason for the tunnel. You're out of your body. You shouldn't be. You're confused. It's like a Hoover. They Hoover you above the. Remember, the first two levels are kind of depressing and awful. They Hoover you to a vibratory rate above that, the lowest two awful levels. And into what appears to be an interim place at about level 3 or level 4 in vibratory rate. And there you have near-death experiences. Isn't that fun? And some of them are very, very elaborate. Some are not. But that's not death. By definition, a near-death experience is not death. And the evidence is very strong that everyone who has a near-death experience, even if they go to a death-ish, heaven-ish kind of place, they don't go to where the dead go. Many of them get to a barrier where they're told, if you go past this point, you'll never be able to go back. And that seems to be when they're getting too close to being where our dead actually are. So near-death experiences are real. They're relatively common now, actually, because so many people can be saved who couldn't have been saved from death before, but they don't involve going to where the dead are going. Those who are actually going through a natural death and they have their loved ones with them typically experience a foggish kind of, can't see anything, but it's not scary. You just go through a little fog. If you look back at that room where you died, it starts to look vague and vapory, and then it disappears. Because remember, it was energy. We're not talking a solid place you walked out of. Then before you, the fog is thinning, and you find yourself in this beautiful, solid, earth-like place. What an extraordinary moment that is. There are people there. There are animals there. Typically, we arrive in a garden, a beautiful formal garden. I should just say this is a very culturally dependent experience. If you die in most of the communications I've read, people had died in either North America or Great Britain, and they seem to have relatively similar afterlife levels. The buildings are described in a similar way, and there are, in the North American at least, there are distant mountains that are snow-capped. It's sort of like you died and went to Colorado, basically. Beautiful plain, and then beyond it, foothills and beautiful mountains that are snow-capped. Where you are is very lush and green. There are colors, though, primarily in the flowers, that you've never seen because they're beyond the visible light spectrum, and many of the dead remark about those wonderful, beautiful, extraordinary colors. You're sort of overwhelmed. You have the people around you that you love, and sometimes more people will join you there in what is typically a formal garden. But people will sometimes say, you know, I just stayed there for a while. I was just enjoying it because it's so beautiful. I was just enjoying the fact that I had survived and everybody was there and I knew I would see other people I loved. Sometimes a little dog from childhood will come and jump into your lap. Every animal that you've ever loved is there waiting for you. There are some reports that one particular dog from childhood wasn't there, but by and large, if you've had a lot of animals in life, you'll be surrounded by animals at your death because they're all young, healthy, and waiting for you, and each of them still really, really loves you just as they loved you, you know, before they left. And so that's kind of overwhelming. In the early part of the 20th century, there were people who complained that so-and-so had just arrived, but you couldn't get near her because of all the damn dogs and cats. And yeah, they do swear sometimes. That's a wonderful detail that many people worry about. I have a horse that I'm looking forward very much to seeing again. I owned him from the age of 6 months to almost 30, and when he died, it was terrible for me. But 4 days later, he gave me a visitation dream. And we're going to talk about signs and other things that the dead do to let us know they're okay. We'll talk about those in a later podcast. But suffice it to say, it was just an extraordinary experience that's still vivid in my mind years later, to have this horse young and healthy and beautiful, and I was driving him again. It was just an extraordinary experience. So he's waiting, and I've decided I'm not going to ride or drive a horse till I get to ride and drive him again. So we have this wonderful, intimate, really almost designed for us, arrival. Let's talk a little about the details of the place where we've wound up. As I said, it's very beautiful, very green, lots of flowers. The flowers and the leaves never fade, never die. The blossoms of the flowers are apparently somehow on some level conscious. They turn their faces toward us as we pass. They give off this beautiful scent and this beautiful energy. You could, if you stick your face into a flower, you don't just get a beautiful smell, but you get this energy, which is, they say, like food. It energizes your spiritual body. Lots of flowers. Trees will reach down and caress you as you pass beneath them. Vegetation isn't only somewhat conscious. It loves us to pieces. So that's kind of amazing and wonderful. You have sensory abilities beyond anything you had here. The two most commonly described are hearing and sight, and how much better they are. There was a man who died almost blind in the 20s or 10s of the previous century, and his family was very concerned when he first came to them through a deep trance medium, were concerned about whether he could see. And he said, I'll tell you how well I can see. About 50 miles, it feels like, from where I am, there's this mountain range. It's beautiful. And then there are foothills against the mountains. And I can see every leaf on every tree on every foothill. So that's pretty good sight. We don't have that kind of sight here. Another thing we don't have is panoramic sight. They say that they can see around them almost, if not 360, pretty close to 360 degree vision, because of course it's what's called mind sight. You're not seeing with eyes anymore, you're seeing with your mind. The same is true with hearing. Your hearing there is so much better, because when you think about hearing here, think about how unlikely it is that it would work at all. You've got three little bones inside your head, hammer, anvil, stirrup, which vibrate, and the vibration affects it's affected by, I don't even understand how this works myself, but in the end it's little hairs that pick up these vibrations and transmit them to your brain where they're interpreted. It's a wonder we can hear at all. But there, they have mind hearing, and the hearing that they have, they say, is so much better. They say you have not heard music till you've heard it here. A big pastime in the first part of the 20th century was concerts, because, of course, most of the people who died then were poor. They didn't have the ability to go to a lot of concerts, and classical music then was big. And so very big in these communications we received 100 years ago was talk about the concerts. All of it open air, because we don't need to worry about weather. And it's always, by the way, daylight there, although they say there are periods of dimming and people can use those to rest, but there's nothing like day and night, and you know, don't need to sleep anyway, so we tend to be doing things all the time. But you can go to a beautiful open-air concert with a stage in the center and an orchestra playing, and they say that the music is so much better. You feel as if you're right front and center of the orchestra, no matter where you think you're sitting in the amphitheater, and the concerts are so beautiful that you can actually see the music as colors forming above the performers. Wow. Some of the people that perform, first back then, they said that Mozart, others who were composers on earth, are still composing, and we get to hear what they're composing in these concerts. But, you know, maybe that's not your kind of thing. The modern performers that I've heard mentioned are Frank Sinatra, John Lennon, especially Elvis. Apparently, Elvis is a more advanced being, but he's determined to stay at level three and keep performing, where level three being where most of us are able to. If you've had a decent life on Earth, nothing heroic, but you haven't been actively hateful, you tend to get to level three pretty easily and be able to stay there. And that's where a lot of these concerts for the masses of people who've just arrived and are getting used to things, these concerts are held. And they are beautiful. And you can hear early Elvis, late Elvis, any Elvis you like. He apparently does it all. When we first get there, there are two experiences all of us have, although they're very subjective, tailored to what's best for us. We have a big party, and we go through judgment. Judgment is real. Let's do judgment first. Soon after you arrive, you'll have a life review, which is a panoramic, sort of holographic review of every single event of your life. You get to feel how you felt at each of those events, even small ones, and you get to feel how you made other people feel. That's hard. People who have talked about this, and a lot of them don't want to talk about it, so people who have talked about judgment say the hardest thing you've ever done is to go through feeling how you made other people feel, because we tend to think we're like okay, and we know why we did the things we did. We can justify them to the moon. But the problem is that the things that we did that maybe hurt other people might have just been careless things. We could have said or done something that would have helped. Or we didn't have to tell our friend, you know, that dress is getting too thin, or all the things that we might have trivially said or done. Those are the things that seem to be awful. The dead tell us the big things they knew about, but the little things they just had no idea how many times it hurt people. Then you're told, okay, it's time to forgive everybody. And I've never seen a report of someone who did not forgive the people who had hurt them. Holocaust Guard doesn't matter. Because it's not real. I mean, those people aren't evil. They were just basically playing a part just as you were. You easily forgive them. But then you're told, okay, now it's time to forgive yourself. Forgive yourself. The dead tell us the hardest thing you've ever done is to go through a review of how you've lived your life and then have to forgive yourself. There's a lot of help there given to us. Most people who reach level three seem to be able to stick it, but not all of them. And if you can't forgive yourself, even with all the counseling and help and support there is for you, you do drift down to level two, which is, I think, what happened in my father's case. He had trouble forgiving himself. And in the end, and he wouldn't appear. Also, I was doing all this research with mediums, and my father would be described, but they would all say he won't talk. And finally, 20 years, almost to the day after his death, he came to a medium who had been consulted by my daughter, and he said to her through the medium, "Will you please ask your mother and her sister to forgive me for having messed up their childhood?" Wow. I never dreamed he would think he had messed up our childhood. I think we had a lovely childhood, but of course he was troubled during his life review by how traumatic it had been for us, that he had taken the opportunity to imbibe excessively on many a weekend, and he couldn't forgive himself for that. So I have forgiven himself to him, him I have forgiven him for that and asked him to forgive himself for that, and I believe he's okay now. But what seems to have happened was, because he had trouble forgiving, he just drifted lower. If you really can't forgive yourself for something that you really blame yourself for, then you're going to level one, and level one is awful. But Jesus again said it. In fact, if you read the Gospels, just the red letters in the Gospels, the words of Jesus, you pretty much get a good summary of what the dead have been telling us is the point of life, which is learning to love and learning to forgive. We can't do it on the afterlife levels. It's too perfect there. I mean, there's nothing to push against when everybody knows what's up. Everybody knows that reality is spiritual, that we're trying to grow spiritually toward the source, and that's a hunger. That's a drive like it. No No sexual or hunger or any drive you've ever had of the body compares to what you'll feel after you've graduated for spiritual growth, because everyone knows that the pleasures and the joys of being at those higher levels that we all yearn for are well worth all the effort it takes in a rough earth lifetime to learn to love and forgive. So give yourself that gift. Doesn't matter what anyone's done to you. Forgive it as if it never happened. That's how we're supposed to forgive. With no matter what, how unlovable someone makes himself or herself, love everybody. When you learn to do those things, it gets easier, by the way, because I know, I'm like you. What? Forgive that? Forgiveness is for yourself. It's a gift you give yourself. In fact, you don't have to tell the person you're forgiving that you forgive him or her. It's not the point. And they don't care anyway, really, usually, except my father. It's about freeing yourself from that anger, that distress that comes with an inability to forgive. So, all right, so let's just say you went through your judgment and you forgave yourself. And most people do seem to, as I say, although maybe sometimes not right away. So then what happens? You have a house there, and the house was typically built by a loved one, usually your parents or friends if it's the first death of a couple, if there's a couple. And if it's that person will arrive, doesn't have anybody to have built the house that the couple lived in, so they'll arrive maybe at mom and dad's house or something. But that second death of a couple, very often the person who is the second to die will end up, even sometimes will wake up in the family's favorite earth home. And there are funny stories told about this, because typically it was the husband who transitioned first. And anyone who's married, I've been married 42 years, anybody who's married knows that men don't pay attention to details. So a number of the wives communicating in the first part of the 20th century were cranky as all get out that the husband messed up the house. Now, got it wrong, the rooms are in the wrong place or something. One woman said, he reversed it, everything's opposite. It's easy to fix those problems. It's just funny to see that we're still the same person after we died. We're really, this is something that tends to disappoint people who communicate. We all think we're going to be massively enlightened. We're exactly the same person after death as before. And that relationship, if it was strong, is stronger than ever. If it wasn't, a lot of people ask me, do I have to be with my spouse there? I'm not. Well, no, you don't. There are people who want to live together for a while at least, and there are people who don't, and there's no rules. There are no rules except the implacable need to grow spiritually, but there's just nothing else. That's what's important. But when we first get there, it's important, too, that we sort of reconnect with the people that we love. A lot of the people that you love eternally are not in bodies right now. You've come in with a group of people who planned their lives to work out together, to learn certain specific lessons and grow in certain ways. And those people who were in this lifetime will come to the party. The party could be held in a public place. It could be held in your house. It's very, very subjective. There can be music, a live chamber orchestra or Elvis or someone. There's not often food, although our bodies are not constructed with internal organs, and therefore the food just disappears. But food and drink, if you want them, you can have them. I should just say parenthetically, we have a body from the time we arrive in the afterlife. Our body is constructed by our mind, and usually it will look like this lifetime that we've just left, maybe when we were 30, somewhere between the ages of 20 and 30. My father, when I finally did a visitation dream with him, he looked about 18. He died at 86. This was a man who did everything to extremes. But typically, we look in the prime of life and beautiful. If we had a missing limb or some issue in our lifetime, we'll sometimes make a body that still has that problem. And so what happens is that if within a very short period of time we haven't constructed the missing hand or whatever's gone, they'll take us to an operating room. They'll say, oh, I see you have a problem. Well, we can fix that. So you go to what looks like an earth-level operating room of your own culture, And they say, we're just going to give you a little general local anesthetic because we want you to watch us do this, and it's not going to hurt. And they'll basically make a show of sewing on that hand. I'll say, can you move the fingers? Oh, look at that. Everything is fine. Go out. You're just fine. And so you leave. You're fine. Of course, there's no seam or anything. I mean, all they were doing was correcting your own perception of your body and making you feel as if you were whole again. And you are. There are reports of people who, for a little while, still used a wheelchair after they got there and then realized they didn't need it. So they got up and walked away. So all of this is to come for us. I mean, a party, imagine a party in which everyone you've ever loved and cared about knows to come and welcome you, and there are people who will be there, and you'll look at that person and you realize that this is one of your closest eternal friends, and yet he was also that awful brother-in-law that you couldn't stand. He was playing a role in this lifetime to help you grow spiritually, and so you fall into one another's arms. It's all a play. It's all a way for you to learn and grow spiritually, because what we have learned above all else is that Max Planck was right. Human consciousness is primary and pre-existing. Your mind never began. Your mind never will end. It is part of that eternal source energy that we talked about before. Your mind is very powerful. It's much more powerful after death than before, because while you're in a body, your mind is kind of dampered by this material body that it's stuck in. There's a lot. You try to make a something on a table, a lamp or something, kind of lift off the table and float around the room and settle back down on the table. You can't do it with your mind. The dead can. The dead can manipulate our reality in amazing ways. They're very careful not to do it much because it can freak us out. But there are reports that are extraordinary of the things the dead can do with their minds, much more powerful than our minds are while we're in bodies. But I hope I've given you a sense, and really just a dawning sense, there's so much more we could talk about in the afterlife, of things people do, the way progress happens, and we'll do that another day. But I hope I've given you a sense of the infinite power and beauty of your own eternal nature, of who and what you really are. You're not material. Nothing is material, it turns out, really. It's all energy. But the only thing that is perfect and forever is eternal mind, of which your mind is a part. You're so much more important, so much more loved than anyone has ever told you. If you want to learn more of the amazing things that I've been learning, and you want to come to better understand what reality is, just go to iTunes and for free go Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes, and there are about a year and a half of podcasts there with wonderful guests. I'll be having them on here as well, but you can learn more and more quickly if you just go to iTunes and Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. If you go to robertagrimes.com as well, there's a podcast page if you ever lose track of where I am. My nonfiction books are The Fun of Dying, Find Out What Really Happens Next, and The Fun of Staying in Touch. And that explores the ways our loved ones communicate with us and the ways we can communicate with them. I have very much enjoyed being able to tell you all of this. I mean, this is exciting. This is a place where I think within perhaps your lifetime, if you're earlier than middle age, we'll all know this stuff. It needs to become common knowledge. Right now, we have to search for it, but not for much longer. My guest next week is Dr. Love. She's an internationally known relationship expert called Jamie Turndorf. I've become her good friend. I think she's a wonderful person. She began as an atheist, and then everything changed in her life when she was in college and she met Jean Pain, who had been an internationally famous Jesuit priest, and they had a love for the ages. Her book is called Love Never Dies, and it talks about this extraordinary relationship she and Jean had, and then he died, and their relationship continues. Because she's a relationship expert, she also counsels us on how to heal our own relationships with the dead. You're going to really enjoy Jamie. She's just a fount of energy and joy. She's a widow, but, of course, she's not really a widow because Jean's with her all the time. Little by little, we're making progress toward forcing mainstream scientific, the mainstream scientific community to actually look at the afterlife evidence. Their stonewalling continues, but more and more evidence is being developed, and weaker are their claims now that this, none of this is real. Of course it's real. The problem is that they are like a fish. Fish don't have any clue that what's around them is water. Water is the environment in which they live. They're very focused on that little, what should we call it, little castle at the bottom of the pool, either a fish pool outdoors or perhaps a fish bowl. So we have these scientific fish that are eagerly examining that little ceramic thing at the bottom of their fish bowl, never noticing that what they're swimming in is spiritual energy. That's all there is. So they won't study the water. They take it for granted. They won't be able to do that much longer because eventually the truth will out. For now, please enjoy this coming week in our one reality, always knowing, never forgetting that you are a powerful, eternal being and you are infinitely loved.